Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness, produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. It goes by different names, telepsychology, telemental health, online talk therapy, but the idea is the same. You access counseling with a licensed professional over the internet. Using your computer, laptop, tablet, or mobile device, you either video chat, email, or text message. Though it's easy, private, and often more affordable than face-to-face consultation, how safe is online therapy? Will your conversations remain confidential? And can you develop a true bond with someone you've never met in person?
With nearly a dozen online therapy companies launching in the past few years, there are many options. For those who may have been hesitant to seek mental health counseling or have limited options due to geography or other restrictions, it can be a good step. But online talk therapy comes with its own set of challenges for both therapist and client. Here to explain is psychologist Dr. Lynn Bufka, Associate Executive Director of Practice Research and Policy at the American Psychological Association. Dr. Bufka frequently serves as a media spokesperson for the APA on topics relevant to professional practice.
Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Bufka. Thank you for joining us.
I'm so happy to be part of this discussion.
So would you explain, how does online therapy work and how is it being used by patients and mental health care professionals?
Well, as you noted in your introduction, there's many formats to it. The one that's been studied the most and for which we have the most evidence for its success is when individuals use video conferencing. So instead of being face-to-face in the same room, they're face-to-face through their computer monitors or other screen so that they're seeing a therapist, the therapist is seeing them, they're having a conversation in real time, they're interacting. So what's different is they're not located in the same physical location, but it's more typical to standard therapy in that there's a structured time period. It's typically 30 to 45 minutes. There are less studied but still used ways of intervening, which would involve more asynchronous communication, which could be through text messaging or email or other ways of interacting where you may not have your comments, thoughts, feelings responded to immediately because the person is not sort of in real time engaged with you. But you might be texting someone and they will text you back, but perhaps not immediately. There might not be a scheduled session time.
But the goal would be to replicate as much as possible the face-to-face circumstances that would happen in, you know, therapy in which the client and the practitioner are in the same room.
Well, at this point, that's certainly how we're thinking of it, with those kinds of communications, that we're still trying to accomplish that same goal of understanding the person's problems and how might we use this mode of communication to deliver the same kind of interventions. I suspect down the road that these other kinds of technologies will evolve in different ways, so that will be mental health care that doesn't look quite like psychotherapy as it has been traditionally delivered, but provides some useful interventions for individuals.
Well, we referenced some of the conveniences of not having to travel somewhere and sit face to face with a therapist, and it's certainly more convenient. Are there other reasons that you can see people seeking out this type of video conferencing, even if there's a good therapist on the next block? What are the advantages?
I think there's a lot of advantages that can occur with this kind of intervention. First of all, therapists have different areas of expertise. There might be a good therapist on the next block, but they may be less familiar with the kinds of problems that you particularly are facing, and so they may not be the best fit for you. Or perhaps you particularly want to have therapy with somebody who's of the same background as you are, the same gender, or certain kinds of characteristics that are important, meaningful to you, you may not find a match in your immediate area. Or perhaps you know the therapist around the corner because of your involvement in the community, and you'd rather have somebody you don't know. So there are reasons like that that people may seek somebody else. From a clinical point of view, you know, there are certain disorders that can make it really hard to actually get to psychotherapy, no matter how physically convenient a location may seem to be. perhaps you have some sort of physical condition that makes travel challenging, or perhaps you have obligations where you're caring for somebody that you really can't physically leave an area for a long enough period in order to go to a regular psychotherapy session. Or perhaps you have a condition such as agoraphobia where you might really have a fear of traveling, and part of what you need to do with the online psychotherapy would be to overcome some of that anxiety so that you can get out the door ultimately to get to therapy. That would be really actually a goal of if you're working with somebody with agoraphobia, is to get them out of the home. But perhaps they're so overwhelmed and distressed by that condition that they can't even get out the door. So those might be some reasons as well that people might look into mental health services through telepractice.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Raff.
And we're talking about online talk therapy with Dr. Lynn Bufka. She is Associate Executive Director of Practice Research and Policy at the American Psychological Association. Dr. Bufka, we've talked about the convenience and the availability of therapy when there may be areas of focus that are not available to someone who's looking for a certain type of therapy in their community. What about the fact that even though in the best circumstance you talk about it, that it's video conferencing, so people see each other face to face, but a lot of times there are subtle cues of body language and facial expression that may not come across the screen that a therapist would experience in person. Is there something lost to that? Because often that's a key to understanding and connecting with a client. How do you compensate for that?
You know, that is something that I think many therapists struggle with and have questions about. The research suggests that therapy delivered via teleconferencing can be as effective as therapy delivered face-to-face. So clearly people are figuring out how to do that and how to pick up on those kinds of cues that you maybe are concerned you'd miss because of teleconferencing. So I think one of the first things is, if a therapist is providing this kind of service, they should have some training in how to do it, from basic things like knowing to look at the web camera when they're talking to their patient and not looking at the patient's image on their screen so that it appears they're making eye contact, so that they perhaps learn to ask certain questions that they wouldn't have to ask if the person was physically in the room with them in order to assess certain aspects of demeanor and behavior. So there's things that it's important for a clinician who's providing care via technology to know and to consider and to incorporate into the ongoing practice that they might not in a face-to-face encounter.
How can a patient be assured that their information remains confidential and private? Because it's only as private as the app or the site is secure online.
That's a very important question. And one of the reasons that we often have concerns about the expanding use of telepractice, because I think, you know, certainly psychologists and other mental health providers are very much trained in issues of confidentiality and how important it is to keep a person's identifiable information secure, to not talk to somebody else about what they're doing in terms of their clinical work. And so it becomes really important, if you're going to engage in intervention using telepractice, to make sure that the vendor that's making that connection for you is well-versed in these kinds of things. Read the privacy information, read the content associated with the vendor in terms of how they guarantee confidentiality, how they guarantee security of materials. Talk with the clinician about those kinds of things. Make sure that that person is cognizant of that and has plans for ensuring that, because certainly things like some video teleconferencing that we might use to, you know, to talk to grandma or whatever, that's not going to have the same level of privacy structures built into it as something that's used for healthcare. So you'll want to look at the agreements, which it's hard for an average person to sort of wade their way through, but to understand that this is a healthcare service that's being offered via technology and needs the same levels of protection. So fundamentally, you're looking at things related to how the service is delivered and the vendor that's being used to do that. That's very important. So I think there's an added onus on the part of the person seeking care to look into that, but I think it can also be expected that the person they're hoping to connect to is aware of that and can address their concerns in that regard.
Have insurance companies kept up with the technology? Are they covering online therapy as they might for an in-person visit?
That varies tremendously. There have been early on some rules, say with Medicare, that video conferencing would be covered if the patient and the therapist were in approved sites. So it wasn't like you could just be at home and receive care that way. You could perhaps go to a satellite clinic associated with the larger hospital system to get care. We're slowly seeing some change for teleconferencing as being an accepted and reimbursable option for care, but we're not seeing that so much with these other kinds of things like an email-based kind of intervention or text messaging kind of intervention.
Dr. Bufka, what advice do you have for people who are considering some form of online therapy? What questions should they be asking before they embark on this?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to make sure the person that's providing care to you has the appropriate credentials. As a psychologist, I need to be licensed, and I need to be licensed in the state in which I am treating somebody. So in that protects the person I'm treating. If I'm treating somebody in Maryland, they can go to the Maryland Licensing Board and file a complaint about what I'm doing or not doing, and the licensing board is obligated to protect the citizens of the state and is concerned about me as a clinician. But I'm not licensed in 49 other states, and so providing care to somebody, say, in New York, they can't go to the New York Licensing Board to complain about me. So you really want to know where your person is licensed as a basic to make sure that they're licensed in the state you're in. That provides you a little more protection. But then beyond that, to also know that they have some competence in delivering care through technology. Not everyone has that skill. So that's one of the first things to think about. I think another thing to think about is if you're receiving care through technology, it becomes incumbent upon you to secure your environment. You know, if you choose to text message with your therapist, don't leave your phone unlocked. Don't do it in a place where somebody's going to oversee your text messages and could potentially read into what's happening there. You have to be more secure in how you're handling your technology. If you're video conferencing with your therapist, do it in a place where you're not going to be interrupted, where you're certain that the security of your system is up to date and people are not going to be able to track your activity through checking in on your computer. So those are some things that become important for the person receiving care to really pay attention to as well. We have to protect our own devices, make sure there's security on that we're in secure locations.
Dr. Lynn Bufka is Associate Executive Director of Practice Research and Policy at the American Psychological Association. Dr. Bufka frequently serves as a media spokesperson for the APA on topics relevant to professional practice. Thank you so much for joining us on Take Care.
Thank you for having me.